Global Connections Television is a privately funded, independently produced program. The opinions expressed on Global Connections are solely those of the moderator and his guests. We invite you to go to the website at www.globalconnectionstelevision.com to view previous shows. If you're involved with a PBS or community access television station or an educational institution that has an intra-campus television hookup, or perhaps a podcast or just a computer and would like to share the programs, please feel free to do so. Global Connections is provided at no cost to help people in the U.S. and worldwide better understand how international issues impact our lives.
Welcome to today's Global Connections program. Today we're going to be taking a look at a really interesting and important organization, ShelterBox. Our guest today is an expert on this topic. Our guest is Carrie Murray, who serves as president of the global disaster relief nonprofit ShelterBox USA. Carrie has worked since 2009 in disaster relief, often serving on the front lines of a disaster. She is also a member of the Montecito Rotary Club. Carrie Murray, welcome to today's Global Connections program.
Thank you so much for having me, Bill.
I appreciate you being with me. Let's jump right into it. What is ShelterBox? When was it formed? Why was it formed? And what we'll get into what it does as we go along.
Sure. So ShelterBox is a global humanitarian relief organization that brings emergency shelter and essential supplies to set up a household when you've been displaced from a disaster or a conflict situation. So it could be earthquakes, tsunamis, hurricanes, floods, but also civil war situations, the war we're seeing currently in Ukraine. And so we respond to the two big displacement crises that are forcing millions of people from their homes every single year. And Bill, there are more people displaced in our world today than any time in recorded history. So as a humanitarian, a nonprofit organization, ShelterBox was founded 23 years ago. We were initially founded by volunteers who were part of an organization called Rotary International. And they saw at the time there was a devastating earthquake. It was called the Gujarat earthquake. That were displacing millions of people. And they wanted to make sure the essential needs were met. One of our basic needs that we all have as humans, and that's the need for shelter. And so they created 23 years ago, the very first shelter boxes, hoping to help maybe a couple of dozen people a year. And fast forward to today, and we're bringing emergency shelter and essential supplies to over 400,000 people every year.
And you're absolutely correct on the number of refugees. I think 20 years ago, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, the Refugee Agency, was working with about 10, 12 million. This year, it's 80 million refugees. And the situation is not improving. It's getting worse. Well, it's a good thing that we've got ShelterBox and the United Nations and many other great groups like that out there to assist. Let me, before we go too far, you are a 501c3, are you not, a nonprofit?
We are. We're a nonprofit organization, and we work all over the world. Since we got started, we've responded in over 100 countries, and that's to over 300 disaster and crisis situations facing our world.
And if our viewers would like, they can go to your website to get more information or to donate. Go to www.shelterboxusa.org, and hopefully everybody will take a look at it. But let's move forward on this. Well, you've got the boxes behind you. They're very impressive.
And I probably should tell you what's inside, right?
That's what you read my mind. What is it?
So the premise behind ShelterBox is really, what are the things that you need to sustain your life if you lose everything in an instant and you're forced to flee your home? So the center of gravity for what we do every day at ShelterBox is the provision of emergency shelter. That can take different shapes and sizes. Sometimes it is a family relief tent. They look like recreation tents, but they are not. They're made for humanitarian purposes. They're made to withstand very harsh environmental conditions and meant for you to live in for a period of months when you've been displaced, providing a temporary home to a family. But we also have a variety of tarpaulin and different tools and different solutions, all with the same intent of really putting a roof over a family's head when they've been displaced. So that's the first thing, the emergency shelter. And really, having a shelter is the first step in the recovery process. If you've been forced from your home, you can't work, kids can't go to school if you don't have the shelter. So that's first. The other things that you think about that we provide that are so essential in emergency situations, like so often in disasters, you've had a lack of power. So we include waterproof solar lanterns, vitally important. You've often had contamination of the water source. So we include a water purification unit, containers to store clean water. Also, you need basic things like mosquito nets in some of these conditions, especially if it's a wet condition, prevent vector-borne disease. Also, things to sleep on. So waterproof ground mats, blankets. Also, aid organizations bring in food and water. But Bill, what are you going to cook a hot meal with and boil water with? So we include a whole stainless steel cooking set to help restore a sense of routine and normalcy for a family around meals. And then essential things like tools. We provide basic things to help people with the repair process. Sometimes clothing in these situations, particularly in the winter months in places like Ukraine, places like Syria. It could be coats, baby onesies, basic things to help people survive and meet them in the moment that they're in. In addition, we have a variety of tarp solutions, and we really try to customize the aid package to meet the unique needs of the families that we're serving, and it's often different.
You mentioned Ukraine a moment ago, and we see that horrible tragedy that's been unfolding for a little over a year now. How do you deal in a war zone? I know the United Nations, they're on the ground over there with the World Food Program, UN Children's Fund, World Health Organization, the whole alphabet soup of UN agencies that can work in a zone like that. How do you, you're a civilian organization, they're civilians too, but how do you deal in a war zone in Ukraine? Where were you operating, and how did you get in and how did you get out safely?
Sure. Well, I was just in Kyiv, Ukraine last month, and at ShelterBox, not only are we responding to natural disasters, the fastest growing piece of our work has been in violent conflict, and we are working in some of the world's most extreme conflict zones. And so Ukraine has been obviously a continuous challenge for many aid organizations to operate there safely, but we've been working since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, and that's because we often work alongside trusted partners, local partners that know really the context of which we're operating in. They live in these communities. They're helping serve as doing beneficiary selection, to training communities on how to utilize the aid, to doing monitoring and evaluation. But we work alongside locals, and we do that in all of our disaster situations around the world. We have lots of different partners. But in the case of Ukraine, we have local community-based partners that are working alongside us, and they're helping in so many facets of the response. So when we were there practically last month, we were working in community centers and doing distributions of winterized aid materials to families that had fled their home and been forced to flee their homes in the eastern part of Ukraine, in Russia-occupied areas of places like Donetsk. And many of these families were living in overcrowded basements. You know, a family I met was living in a basement with 60 people. Many of them don't have heat, don't have electricity. And so it's the community-based partners that we work with that really help us to identify the most vulnerable people who've been displaced and really work to meet the needs of how best to serve them. In the case of informing this response, it's the middle of winter, it's freezing. They needed basic things like high thermal sleeping bags because it was just as cold inside as outside because there was no heat. They also needed solar lanterns. They needed clothing. They needed stoves, just the basic things to help them survive the winter. So in these disaster context situations, it's very complex. It's always an evolution over time. We're constantly looking at how can we best meet the needs of that moment that they're in. But we often rely on local partners to help support us.
That is extremely important. And when you mentioned partners, were you in collaboration with OCHA, the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, UN Children's Fund, yes. UNICEF, some of the other.
So we often coordinate within the UN system, the cluster system, which has really been developed for the effective and efficient coordination of humanitarian aid. And it helps us to work together with other local nonprofit partners. But also, we want to make sure we avoid duplication. We want to make sure we reach the most vulnerable. And so we do have a coordination mechanism that we feed into that's underneath the United Nations.
It's so important to have that coordination. It's extremely important so that you don't have that duplication of services, and also you don't have populations who are ignored, others who may be overserved or something like that. So it's very important. Now, you mentioned that you have the tents, but you also provide other services. What are some of the other services that you do besides the boxes behind you?
Yeah, so the box, we've really evolved very far beyond the box. And that's because there's not a one-size-fits-all solution in this line of work. And so sometimes it means bringing in aid materials. In the case of our ongoing responses right now in southern Turkey and northern Syria for the series of earthquakes, which devastated the region in early February, we are providing humanitarian relief tents. And we have, in instances, flown those in to places like Turkey. But we're also finding local suppliers in many of these locations that we work with continuously, such as the case in Turkey, that in Gaziantep, we've been working for years, over 11 years, because of the Syrian conflict. We've been responding to the Syrian refugee crisis. So we have a supplier and a warehouse we're working with in country that actually help manufacture the products that we need locally. So right now, it's everything from blankets, sleeping bags, clothing. And so sometimes it's a tent, as you mentioned, but oftentimes it's other aid items. It's also, we do a lot of shelter kits, which are tarpaulins and tools and fix-ins, which actually help repair homes that have been damaged so people can temporarily shelter in place. We're doing thousands of those right now in Ukraine, because so many people are living in homes that have been damaged by the bombings. So we're doing things like tarps, which help provide a roof on a house or walls on a home that's been damaged by the bombings. We all often do things like plastic sheeting for the windows to cover up those open exposed windows in these instances. We're also doing basic things like corrugated iron. We do basic things like mattresses. So we did thousands of mattresses at the beginning of the war in Ukraine because so many people were sleeping in evacuation and collective centers, and they just needed to get a bit of rest. So we're doing thousands of mattresses to help them just provide some basic comfort and meet them in the moment that they're in. So there's so many different types of displacement situations that we're responding to, and it really forces us to really adapt to those needs. And it more and more, we're moving to a very much a localized approach, which could mean procuring items in the regions that we're working with.
We can all remember seeing the horrific, horrific devastation after the earthquakes in Turkey, and just hundreds, thousands of tons of concrete just piled on top of more concrete. And of course, undoubtedly, a lot of people did not survive that. But when you go into an area like that, that's just been just totally destroyed almost, it reminds me of the horrific earthquake in Haiti back in, I think, 2010, something like that, where 80% of Port-au-Prince, Haiti was destroyed. But when you go into Turkey and you see the devastation with the concrete and the streets are blocked, you can't get vehicles in there. How do you operate? Or do people move out of, have to move out? Obviously, you can't live there. But do you have an area nearby where you can set up? Is there a flat field, or is there some place, some stadium where you can operate or something like that?
Yeah. So the first phase of a response for ShelterBox is always assessment. And we did not just send materials in. We go in and actually do an assessment to determine what's actually needed. And we want to avoid duplication. We want to provide the most effective and efficient humanitarian relief supplies. So that means we go onto the ground and we coordinate. In the case of Turkey, in southern Turkey, our teams on the ground have been coordinating with one of our longest partners, and that's Rotary International. And so we've been partnering with Rotary in Turkey, and they've been really amazing sources of information. They're helping with logistics. They're helping with transportation. They're helping serve as volunteers. And so our teams that have been there during the duration of this response, they've experienced aftershocks in the hotels that they're staying in, which is obviously a very scary situation. We have a situation where over 50,000 people have been killed. And as you can see, millions of people displaced, and so many areas are just rubble. And yes, it is very much reminiscent of what we saw in Port-au-Prince in Haiti in 2010. In that disaster, you had 250,000 people that were killed and over 1.5 million people displaced. And so our teams, they go to the ground, they conduct assessments, they really determine what aid items are going to be most valuable, who's most vulnerable that we can serve. We often prioritize the most vulnerable. Those often happen to be elderly, disabled, it could be women, it could be lactating mothers, children. So we look at where we can be most effective and judicious with the humanitarian relief supplies. Obviously, we can't meet the entire need. That's why there's lots of nonprofits that are responding to this situation. But we are going to try to help the most vulnerable in this situation.
And of course, Rotary is one of the biggest nonprofits out there. And I'm glad you mentioned it. In fact, when we come back in just a minute, we'll talk a little bit about Rotary. Sure. Well, you're watching Global Connections Television, which is a privately funded, independently produced program. The opinions expressed on Global Connections are solely those of the moderator and his guest. We'd invite our viewers to go to our website at www.globalconnectionstelevision.com to view previous programs. Also, if you're involved with a PBS or community access television station, or perhaps an educational institution that has an intra-campus television hookup, or you have a podcast, or you have a computer and you like our shows and you'd like to share them, please feel free to do so. Global Connections Television is provided at no cost as a public service to help us better understand international issues and how they impact our lives. Today, we're taking a look at a really unique and important organization called ShelterBox. And my guest is an expert on this topic. My guest is Carrie Murray. Carrie Murray serves as the president of the global disaster relief nonprofit ShelterBox USA. Carrie, you were talking a minute ago about Rotary International, a group that's near and dear to both of our hearts since we're both Rotarians. And of course, now Rotary has 1.2 million members around the world, has over 35,000 clubs in over 200 countries and territories, which is the largest service club in the world, or right up there with Lions. They say they're larger, and Rotary says they're larger, so we won't quibble over that. But where, you talk about the Rotarians who were there. Where did they come from? They all weren't Ukrainian Rotarians. I know Rotary is big in Ukraine, but were these volunteers who came in from around the world, or who were these folks?
Oh, actually, when I was in Kyiv, Ukraine, I met with one of the past district governors who lives in Kyiv, who is running several humanitarian projects with Rotary locally in Kyiv. And the same thing when we look at our response in southern Turkey, our team is coordinating with local Turkish Rotarians that are on the ground that live in these communities. They know the context. They know the language. They are absolutely vital to our responses in disaster situations, and they have been since we got started 23 years ago.
That is so important to have your partners on the ground. You have to have them. If you don't, it can be an absolute disaster. Well, let's shift over to Syria and talk a little bit about that. That's a bit of a different setting. I guess you were in the war-torn areas of Syria. Is that correct?
The longest and largest piece of our response at ShelterBox has been responding to the Syrian crisis. We have been actively responding for over 11 years. And that is both to Syrian refugees who fled the country early on in places like Lebanon and places like Greece. But then we've also really turned our attention the past several years to people who've been internally displaced within Syria. And we've been able to bring emergency shelter and supplies to over 50,000 thousand families over that time. It is a very large response for our organization.
Now, you mentioned a minute ago about sourcing, and of course, that's extremely important in that you get the equipment and the materials to the people who need them as quickly as possible and as cheaply as possible, too, so there's more money for other items to be purchased. Are you sourcing locally, for example, in Syria? Did you have someone making the shelter boxes in that area, or did you have to ship them from the UK or from wherever in Europe where they're put together?
It's a great question. For our response in Syria, we've actually been procuring and sending aid items in to Turkey, and we've been doing this for years. So some items we produce in Gaziantep, things like our high thermal blankets. We're also producing children baby onesies and clothing and boots for the winter months. But a lot of the aid materials that we send in then get packaged together and taken to the border. And at the border of Turkey and Syria, we then transfer those materials to our humanitarian partners, long-term trusted partners we've been working with in Syria for years. That includes organizations like Relief Aid and also Bahar Organization. So when the earthquakes hit, and it obviously killed thousands of people in northern Syria as well, some of the people that were most affected in Syria had already been displaced many times. They were already the most vulnerable. And so this was another tragedy on top of a crisis they've been experiencing for years. So initially, when that happened, we were in touch with our local partners. And because it was still the winter months, we had aid in country in warehouses that we were able to immediately redeploy to families who had been affected by the series of earthquakes. So initially, we did have aid in country. Other aid that we have will be coming in, obviously, through Turkey. But we were fortunate in that in such a difficult place to work, we've been working there for 11 years. It's been very quiet work. I think a lot of people didn't even realize we were working there until this series of earthquakes hit, but it put us in a very good position to respond. And actually, our work in Syria and in some of the world's most extreme conflict zones is the reason why in 2018 and 2019, ShelterBox was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And it's for our work in these very difficult humanitarian situations that are displacing millions of people.
That is a tremendous honor that ShelterBox certainly deserved. Just being nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize is a remarkable accomplishment. Well, as you've been involved in the humanitarian effort for the last several years, and I know you've met thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people over this period. You've had all types of encounters. Is there one really most memorable moment that you'll cherish for the rest of your life?
I would say just a recent moment I had was in Kyiv and in Ukraine. And there was a series of moments. And I've met people who have been displaced, who had 15 minutes to flee. And I met a family with a daughter that is the exact same age as my daughter, freshman in college. They had 15 minutes to flee the Severodonetsk region. And they found their way to Kyiv Oblast. And they had been sleeping in a basement, with overcrowded basement, often without power because the Russia airstrikes have been targeting power infrastructure to really weaken the Ukrainians. So taking out heat, water, electricity. And so this family had been living with often no power, with 60 other people in an overcrowded basement. And because of the work of the community-based foundations we were working with, they were able to access a small apartment living with other families. And they had really nothing. They were starting over. And so this family's life had stopped for a period of months. And so they came to the distribution and we were providing them with high thermal blankets and sleeping bags, also some clothing, solar lanterns, and a stove. And I was helping the family carry the materials out, and they all at once just embraced me. And I asked them if these items were going to be helpful to them. And the father said, super. We were kind of trying to, we were speaking through translator, but he knew the word super. And he hugged me and the family was in tears. And it was just the most basic things for survival that they need to get back on their feet. And it was the hopefulness that they had for the future. And these are just the absolute building blocks and the foundations for life to get them going again. And the daughter's been displaced from school, obviously. So she's hopeful to go back and she dreams of being a doctor. But it's so often we see that these very basic, simple things that we take for granted are just lifelines to these families. And they're very basic, they're inexpensive, but they can really transform someone's life.
Well, Carrie Murray, ShelterBox has certainly been one of those major lifelines to literally tens of millions of people around the world over the past several years. But I want to thank you for all you've done and also to thank you for a very interesting and a very informative program.
Thank you so much.
I'm Bill Miller. Thank you for joining us today on Global Connections Television.